and welcome back to the new season of Tales from Wisteria Lane, the podcast where we give you a fair view of all things Desperate Housewives. I'm Joel.
I'm Billy Ray.
And today we are starting season 8, the final season.
Yes, the disaster season.
Yeah, disaster, it depends on how you mean disaster.
Disaster episodes are where something really bad happens, and this season is because of something really bad that happened.
Oh, okay, so it's got nothing to do with the fact that you find this season to be a disaster.
No, I enjoyed this season for the most part.
Okay, cool. Well, okay. So I will be doing the overview of the episode and B will be doing the trivia. So what of the first trivia do you have for season 8?
So this episode was written by Bob Daly, directed by David Grossman, and it first aired on the 25th of September 2011, and it's the 158th episode of Desperate Housewives. This is the part where I would normally say that makes it the 158th episode of this podcast if you don't count our Christmas special, A Kiss Before Christmas. I'm not going to do that moving forward, so I will trust you guys to just remember, please.
Thank God.
The title of this episode comes from a lyric in the song I Know Things Now, taken from the Stephen Sondheim musical Into the Woods. On this week, the number one songs on this day were Moves Like Jagger by Maroon 5 featuring Christina Aguilera in the US, and No Regrets by Dappy in the UK.
Oh god, I hated No Regrets.
Moves Like Jagger is a song that I don't like to listen to anymore.
Oh, I loved it at the time. Mostly for Christina Aguilera's bit.
I grow tired of it now.
Yeah, me too.
Funnily enough, when the music video came out, I was very attractive to Maroon 5 singer.
You mean you were attracted?
What did I say?
You were very attractive. That to too. Maroon 5. So are you trying to say that the lead singer of Maroon 5 found you very attractive?
Oh, possibly. I found him very attractive. And as I've become an adult, I look back and I'm like, no.
I mean, he's not unattractive. Don't get me wrong. It's just, but he's a certain type.
He's very slim. And yeah. I thought he was muscular back then.
And very tattooed. He's very tattooed as well.
On the 19th of September 2011, Ashton Kutcher debuted as the main character, replacing Charlie Sheen in the TV show 2.5 Men.
Yes.
And on the 20th of September 2011, Call Me Maybe by Canadian singer Carly Rae Jepsen was released.
Yes, icon. Icon, legend, the moment, the star, Carly Rae Jepsen. We love you in this household.
Yes, listen to The Loveliest Time.
Mm-hmm.
TV show New Girl, starring Zooey Deschanel, debuted on Fox.
Okay, yeah.
And the US ended the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, allowing queer people to serve openly in the military for the first time.
Yay.
Let's talk about reception and fan response, which is quite a big part of the trivia here.
Okay.
This episode was watched by 9.93 million viewers, making it the least watched season premiere in the show's history.
Oh my god, really?
However, the final minute of the episode drew 12.188 million viewers and also gained an extra 2 million viewers from its original broadcast due to DVR recordings. This, from the trivia that I've done for all of my episodes in the season so far, is quite a commonly recurring thing. It would appear that being able to record TV shows meant that not a lot of people were watching them as they came out.
That's true, yes.
Secrets That I Never Wanted to Know garnered positive reviews from TV critics. TV Fanatics' Christian Tran praised the murder cover-up and the episode's comedy, ultimately saying, overall, the season premiere comprised of suspense, jokes, and touching moments amongst the housewives, from the funny car theft scene to the housewives' swim-only scene. It is absolutely refreshing and nice to have the ladies back. She gave the episode 4 out of 5 stars. Meanwhile, TV Guide's Kate Stanhope, while commending the character of Brie morphing back into the controlling perfectionist we grew to love, was somewhat critical of Lynette's story, adding, "It's annoying that their relationship has been reduced to this gimmick." Concluding, Entertainment Weekly called the episode's overall story too juicy a landmine to not have the repercussions play out deliciously on this, the show's last season.
Okay.
Fans of the show responded overwhelmingly positive to the episode. Many were pleased with the way that the writers handled the murder cover-up, as well as the introduction of Bree's blackmail. One fan wrote, "A dramatic conclusion to the murder of the last season that mental rips the girls apart," whatever that means, "affecting their marriages, families, and more than anything, their own friendships with each other. I can't believe I say those things about this show after all it's been through, but this episode was well worth it." And it was given an 8.4 out of 10 rating on TV.com.
Nice.
Now let's talk about some episode trivia. The episode was one of 2 season premieres that Mark Cherry, the creator of the show, didn't write himself. ABC announced on the 7th of August 2011 that season 8 would be the last season, which apparently gave the writers more freedom when writing storylines. Vanessa Williams says that the first day of shooting was the 11th of July 2011. Apparently, the writers were intentionally bookending the show by setting up a murder mystery similar to season one. In an interview with E! News, Mark Sherry stated that mystery harkens back to the first season, going back to the roots of Mary Alice. This feels right for that mystery to take us out this year. This can be found on the website with the title Desperate Housewives, Mark Sherry on series end, and I quote, "I wanted to go out in the classiest way possible," end quote, dated the 7th of August, 2011, written by Drusilla Morehouse.
Okay.
I think we mentioned that a few times in the last episode of our podcast about how it really connects back to season one as well, didn't we?
Yeah.
This episode introduces neighbour of the season, Ben Faulkner, played by Charles Messier. He's an actor born in Somerset, England, who grew up in Australia, studied law at Sydney University, and graduated from the National Institute of Dramatic Arts, or NIDA, in Sydney, and then moved to the US where he got several supporting roles on hit TV shows. His top roles on IMDb include DSS Keese Van Damme in 51 episodes of Street Legal, Tim's father in the 2005 movie Boogeyman, Kyle Hobbs in 18 episodes of V, and Ryan Waters in 26 episodes of City Life. Now, there's no shade to this actor, and from what I remember, no shade to the character, but I don't think about him.
Oh, shade to the character, definitely.
I just don't really remember the character. The only storyline I remember is the one that starts in this particular episode where Renee is trying to pursue him and he doesn't respond.
I remember his future storyline.
Well, I remember a part of a storyline in particular, but I don't remember what led to that. Anyway, bloopers and continuity errors. In Come Over for Dinner, Alejandro is seen driving a two-door Ford Focus, but when Brie and Gabrielle go to dispose of the car in this episode, it's a four-door model. When Gabby and Brie are trying to get rid of Alejandro's car, Gabrielle says that she last drove a manual car in college, but this is incorrect as she actually drove one when she drove Hector's car back to her house.
That's true!
And lastly, Gabby says that she's been afraid of Alejandro all of her life and that she feels finally safe, but she thought he was dead most of her life, so why would she be afraid of him still? That's what it was said on either the Desperate Housewives fan site or IMDb. But even if she did think he was dead, I can still understand why she'd still be afraid of him her whole life.
Yeah.
Because of trauma. But there you go.
Also, on top of the continuity errors, there's another one as well, which is mentioned twice in this episode. And I correct me if I'm wrong, I could be wrong, but Gabby mentions twice in this episode that she went to college.
Yeah.
I don't think she ever went to college. She ran away from home at the age of 15. And in this episode, when she takes Carlos to confession and he doesn't confess, Gabby jumps into the confession and says, "I once made out with two chicks in college."
I'm pretty sure that the story is that she, left home young to pursue modelling in New York, right?
Well, I don't know if she did it to pursue modelling in New York, but I know that she ran away from home because of the SA with Alejandro. And the fact that she wasn't believed and ended up in New York and became a model.
So quite a few continuity errors there.
Mm.
But anyway, that's all of my trivia. There was loads.
There was loads.
So much trivia.
Okay. So previously on Desperate Housewives, Brie and Chuck have gotten serious. Tom and Lynette have decided to separate. Gabby's stepfather Alejandro returned for revenge on Gabby until Carlos killed him during Susan's return to the Lane dinner party, and the ladies walk in but agree to make a pact to protect Gabby and Carlos.
Damn right.
So let's start with just the opening scene, which I've slapped in Gabby's, to be fair. So the party has ended. Now we end pretty much straight after season seven. Or we start, sorry, pretty much straight after season seven has ended.
Yeah, we pick right up. There's no time jump this time.
No time jump.
Imagine, so 5-year time jump.
Oh god. No, so we can assume that there's a couple of hours of a time jump. there's been some party time.
Yeah. They've partied hearty.
Yeah. So the party's ended and all the ladies have stayed behind at Gabby's to help clean up. And Brie does a very un-Brie thing here. And she flips open the chest of drawers, which Alejandro's sort of crammed into. And it has dirty plates and cutlery still on top and they just go tumbling to the floor.
Oh, God.
That's a very, un-Brie thing. And that's what Brie does. So she means business this season.
That's how you know that she is actually a little bit pressed and she's hiding it pretty well.
Yeah. During the night, they carry the body out to the woods and bury him there. Carlos leaves to move the car and Susan and Lynette freak out about what they're doing, but Brie is the one that keeps a level head and tells everyone to stay focused. They begin to bury when Alejandro's phone then goes off. Susan and Lynette then freak out again, although Susan a bit more so, and it's only really made worse when they grab the phone and see that it says home.
Oof.
Susan suggests calling the police again because they're bound to get caught because people like them always get caught. But Gabby won't agree to that, especially because since the murder, they have continued to party, driven to the woods and tried to bury the guy. So,
yeah,
a bit late now.
I mean, they all held it together so well during the party, and how they did that is beyond me because there must have been a few people that thought, God, they're acting weird tonight.
Yeah.
But there you go. And when I first watched this, I didn't expect Lynette to act the way that she does. I think I remember talking to you about this. I thought that she'd be a bit more of the strong leader type, like Bree.
Yes.
But she doesn't really hold up too well.
She crumbles.
I think Lynette is very showy with strength, isn't she? But she really is quite sensitive.
I also just think Lynette's got her own stuff that she's going through at the moment. I think that if Lynette wasn't going through a bit of a breakup right now, she'd be in a better mental headspace.
Maybe.
And would be able to handle it. But because Lynette's currently going through a separation with her husband, I think this on top of that is just, it's too much for her to handle.
Yeah.
So again, Bree is the little guiding star of the group and calms everyone down, telling them that they speak of this to nobody. And when this body is buried, so is the secret. And they all put their hands in. Susan a little bit more lackluster, but she does do it eventually. And they move on with their lives. And like, honestly, from the very fucking beginning, Susan and Lynette have been the weak links.
Well, Lynette can't even look the women in the face when she puts in her hand.
Yeah.
It's like she's agreeing to it, but she's not agreeing that she's going to be very strong during the whole process.
Yeah. Like, I would have thought, just like going on about what we just said a few minutes ago, that Bree would have had a harder time with this because of her sort of devout faith.
Yeah, but she's not adverse to covering up murder.
No, that's true. That is true. We've seen it before.
Big up Bree, though. Protecting her friends at all costs. Yeah. What a friend.
And Susan, we all knew, isn't strong enough to handle this. We all know that, right?
I think we all could have suspected how Susan would handle this, to be quite honest.
So Mary Alice then tells us that a month has passed, and since then, this cover-up has affected everyone in different ways, and their lives have started moving forward. Carlos is harboring guilt about a crime that he can't actually talk about, and is just laying in bed awake. Gabby, on the other hand, doesn't really seem to be too bothered, and she's getting on with her life.
Yeah, good for her.
Right? Juanita comes in, proud of herself for making waffles for her mum and dad for breakfast, and Gabby's too tired to care, and Carlos then snaps at Juanita, telling her to get out of their room, and then Juanita cries and runs off.
Oh, this was such an out-of-character moment of kindness, and because Carlos has decided to take this moment to snap at her, she'll probably never do something nice again.
No, I know, and even Gabby's like, Carlos, what the hell?
Yeah, come back when you make my mom says.
Gabby calls him out in his short temper recently, and Carlos blames the fact that he murdered someone. So she tells him that they have to move on, but he doesn't really seem to be able to, no matter how much he wants to. He wants to go to a priest so that he can talk to someone, but Gabby is worried that that will really only make Carlos feel more guilty.
I found that a bit entertaining because we'd be like, okay, you are harboring some feelings, you're bottling stuff up, you clearly need a therapist.
Yeah.
But the Catholics are like, I need a priest.
Yeah, the Catholics just go, oh, I need to go to church right away.
Right? That's just going to an unpaid, uneducated therapist, basically.
Yeah.
Like a therapist that doesn't know what they're talking about.
Pretty much. But they do have the Bible, so, you know, little from column A, little from column B.
Yeah, true.
Gabby does give in and she lets Carlos go talk to a priest if that's what he needs to do. At church, he goes into confession but is put off by the fact that the other person is not Father Dugan, but some young newbie. And it's his first week of confession and he was about to slip up and tell Carlos some of the stuff he heard.
Possibly a little gay.
Possibly.
Possibly a little gay priest.
Well, yeah.
You know, the way he's like, oh, dish. Spill the tea, honey. What
yeah,
you done?
Yeah, he was there ready. He was just like, oh my God, I really thought this was going to be a good one. Like, what's the tea, Christine?
Right, he's like, oh, you can confess until the cows come home, honey. Like, he's on it.
Carlos changes his mind, but then Gabby comes into the booth and stops him, telling him this person looks perfectly enthusiastic. But Carlos refuses and goes, leaving the newbie somewhat disappointed. So Gabby quickly comes back, confesses her experimental phase in college, and goes.
Yeah, that was weird. Also, Gabby barging in gave a very weird marriage counselling kind of vibe. I was like, what the hell is this? I thought this was a confessional.
Yeah, that's true.
Also, Carlos, for God's sake, just confess to the gay dude and get it over with.
You say he's gay, but Gabby was there saying, I made out with two chicks in college. And then the priest goes, this job rocks.
Yeah, true.
So he's so going home and having a wank to that image.
He's not allowed to. He'll probably just, I don't know, whip himself. I don't know.
You say he's not allowed to. He'll go home and do that.
He'll probably do that anyway.
Of course he'll do that anyway. Later on down the line, an undisclosed amount of time later, Gabby returns to the church and manages to catch Father Dugan before he gets on his flight for charity work. He's going to build wells or something, but he isn't interested in stopping because God doesn't get a say over the airlines. Gabby tricks the cab driver and kidnaps the priest, taking him to her place so he can speak to Carlos before he goes. But what she doesn't realize is that she's caught two randos as well, who are clearly those people that have to be at the airport like 5 weeks before their flight.
Sorry, but Gabby kidnapping a priest is, and stealing a taxi is so unhinged. Like, this behavior, like, do you want to get arrested on top of the crap that you're already going through? This is a terrible idea.
I mean, you say it's unhinged, but what she actually says is the unhinged part.
There's so much wrong with what's happening here. It's bonkers.
She's like, oh, honey, you can relax. Since we caught Bin Laden, you can stroll onto the plane anytime you want. That has aged.
That's aged horrendously. You still can't stroll onto the plane whenever you want. You
absolutely cannot stroll onto the plane whenever you want.
However, you don't have to arrive that many hours early. It is a myth.
Yeah. At the Solis house, Carlos is talking to Father Dugan, who tells him that God can forgive anything, providing he repents and essentially takes accountability, such as going to jail for a crime. Carlos, however, can't admit anything now because there are so many others involved who are essentially innocent. Father Dugan then doesn't want to leave Carlos in the state that he's in, worried that he's not going to be okay, and Carlos basically says that he doesn't really see how he can ever be okay.
Yeah, that was sad.
Carlos really irritates me this season because I find him to be really overdramatic.
He is, but this is a very heavy thing that he's got burdening his soul, and as a religious person, and a Catholic religious person of all things, guilt is already a daily part of life, I'm pretty sure, so this must be a lot.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Like, you've heard the Alanis Morissette song. You know how us Catholic girls can be.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah.
You know, forgiven.
Yeah. No, I get that, obviously, his religion helps to fuel his guilt, and it overemphasizes it almost. But he did what he did for a very good reason. And I get that he can't tell anybody about it, and he can't take accountability for his actions in theory. But for me, I would be... At least I would like to think that I would justify what my actions with the knowledge that I've done it for, the very reason that I've done it for. I did it because not only did he do what he did to my wife so many years later, but I walked in on him trying to do it again.
True. I completely agree with you. But don't forget, this is the same religion that says that babies that aren't christened don't go to heaven if they die.
Yeah, that's true. That night, Gabby comes to check on Carlos, thanking him for what he did and reminding him that what he actually did was protect her from a man who she couldn't escape from. But for the first time in forever, she is no longer scared, and in taking another man's life, he saved hers.
Mm-hmm.
So she's trying to help him kind of justify his actions on a moral.
She says, if you're looking for absolution, I give it to you.
Yeah.
That was nice. And Frank Eva is showing off.
She is showing off. She is a solid actress.
Eva Longoria's like, I told you I could act. Watch this.
She's like, eh.
So that was a really nice ending to that story.
It was a really nice ending to Gabby and Carlos' story. I don't quite think that's going to be enough for Carlos.
Absolutely not. It's a shame.
He needs
because it feels like this should end this whole thing.
Right here and now. Yeah.
It would be a satisfying conclusion. But I guess it's a start, really. It means that he can really work on forgiving himself because he's received the absolution. Now he just needs to work on himself.
But what Carlos needs is absolution from his God.
You're not going to get that.
Yeah, I know, but that's the thing. What he doesn't need is absolution from his wife.
Yeah.
So that's that. Let's do Renee. We'll do Renee really quickly. She's just got a really short one. So the ladies are all outside having coffee and checking out the new neighbor's things, wondering what he is like.
Neighbor of the season.
He is neighbor of the season. Renee comes over and they notice that he is at least rich and single. So now they just need to see what he looks like. Gabby said she saw him in the morning and starts talking about how awesome and hot he is. And while she's gushing over him, he appears behind her, making her jump and causing her to introduce herself as Susan to save face.
That was so quick. Good for you, Gabby.
I'm Susan Delfino.
However, so embarrassing, so horrible to watch.
She's there. What does she say about him?
She said something about how he's really hot and the things that she would do to him or something.
Yeah, she said like she could still... She's like, oh, I'm not dead, Briex. Don't imagine all the naughty things I do to him.
And he's right behind her.
Right behind her.
Horrible.
After a brief chat where he basically sort of implies that Gabby's knowledge of him is a little bit off. Only slightly, but a little bit off. He walks off and Renee calls dibs and follows.
Yeah, she does. I do love that they know that he's single because of that giant fish thing.
Yeah, he's like, he's single. Check out the fish.
I didn't think you could get those anywhere other than restaurants or bars or something. Like giant fish on the wall.
Where do you think they get them from?
I don't know. It's just horrible.
Like, what? It was a horrible fish.
What a horrible thing to have on your wall.
Yeah.
At least it doesn't talk.
Later on, Renee heads over to Ben's to reel him in. But as they haven't actually spoken before, Lynette believes that he might not even be interested. And This is where we get one of the best opening requests for sex in television history. And we have a clip.
Hi. I'm going to save us some time. Look, I'm single. You're single. I'm hot. You're hot. Assuming you're not gay and those shoes tell me you're not, we could do that thing where we flirt for a few weeks. You can stare at my ass getting the mail, and I do get my mail 4 times a day. Or you could invite me in for coffee.
Thanks for the offer, but I'm good.
Excuse me. When I said coffee, you did know I meant sex, right?
Oh, you were subtle, but yeah, I got it.
So embarrassing.
I'm just going to say it, and all of you fans are probably going to come for me for saying it, but Edie could never.
Edie could never?
Edie could never do that. Edie never had the balls to walk up to a person and just be like that.
Well, Edie knows how to reel them in slowly, but this is a different kind of confidence.
Renee, like, cuts through all the bullshit. She cuts through all of the unnecessary fluff. Renee isn't going to do what Edie did with Mike and, like, try and wash the car and, like, get his attention that way on the street. Like, she's just going to go straight up to Ben and be like, I'm hot, you're hot, let's have hot sex.
Yeah, if Edie was still around, they would fucking hate each other.
Absolutely they would hate each other because they'd be going for the same people. Edie would have gone straight for Ben, but she wouldn't be going for Ben the way that Renee does it with Renee's like unblasted confidence. Edie would set herself up a little car wash station and be like, oh, I'm just washing cars and being sexy. Like,
yeah, and this must be such an ego boost for Ben, but honestly,
what a knockdown for Renee though. Ben's got his ego boosted and then he demolishes Renee's right there.
This is only the first episode of the new neighbor of the season and it's only the second scene and two housewives have just completely embarrassed themselves and it's so uncomfortable.
I know. Like, even after Renee clarifies what she wants, Ben closes the door on the best opportunity he has ever had. And he embarrasses Renee in front of her bestie. Lynette is right there.
It's so much worse that Lynette is right there when he closes the door in her face.
Like, just imagine you get shot down in front of your bestie.
It probably does. It doesn't help that she insulted the shoes. Like, he may be straight, but that's probably still not a good way to try and get laid.
Oh, come on.
And those shoes say that you're not. Like, like, he's like, yeah, I'm not gay, but those are my shoes, man.
So that's Renee's story so far. She's got a little bit of a hint of a story, but...
I suppose so.
It's the start of one, at least, which is about damn time.
They're the new Susan and Mike.
It's what I'm going to say. Yeah, yeah, they are the new Susan and Mike. Anyway, so let's move on to Lynette. Further to what Mary Alice said, see, it's been a month and the crime has affected people in different ways. And for Tom and Lynette, it doesn't really seem to have affected them very much. However, they are no longer sharing a bed, and he is sleeping on the floor in Mike and Susan's garage, or above it, I think.
I think it's a spare room.
It might be. I don't know what it is, but oh well. He wakes up late and freaks out, running home before everyone wakes up so the kids don't notice anything, but it's too late, and he sees them all having breakfast, so instead, he quickly hatches a plan and runs to the car to get coffee that's been sat there for 3 days and tells the kids he woke up early and went to get coffee for Lynette.
Yeah, isn't she the best? She deserves it.
What actual fuck? In actual marriage, he would never have done this. And he's like, oh, this would be a good plan.
It's not a good plan. You're acting weird.
Yeah. Tom tells Lynette that they have to tell the kids, but it sounds like she's just kind of making up excuse after excuse not to. First, it was Penny's birthday, which I will give.
Mm-hmm.
I would give them Penny's birthday. And then it was something else, and it was something else after that. And I was just like, oh, okay.
It's embarrassing behavior, especially considering that their last scene together, they were like, oh, how are we going to tell the kids? And they were both like, oh my God, the kids. But I suppose Tom's the one that said that. So Lynette is just very not about that life right now.
I imagine that Lynette would have been more than happy to separate sooner if the crime hadn't happened.
Oh yeah, I think the normalcy of their situation is really helping her somewhat hold it together right now. So yeah. the idea of them telling the kids that they have separated and making it almost real,
mm-hmm,
is probably not a viable option for her right now.
Yeah. So they both agree that they still want to separate because they have stuff to work on. And then Paige wakes up ending the conversation.
Yeah.
Saved by the crying baby bell. Next scene, Lynette has a horrid nightmare that wakes her up in the middle of the night. And so this seems to be how it's now affecting Lynette.
Yeah.
She's struggling to sleep. She has nightmares.
Very creepy nightmare.
In the middle of the night, she goes running to Tom across the street, telling him that she really needs him, and then they fuck.
Yes, they do.
The next morning, they both wake up late again, freaking out about the fact that they aren't home with the kids, and they make it in time and manage to quickly talk about last night. And Tom says that he is open to them getting back together, providing that they put in the serious work.
No.
I know, it's really awkward.
Honey.
Lynette apologises and tells Tom that last night was not about getting back together, but she just had a bad dream. Tom is then gagged that a grown-ass woman has had a nightmare and so fucks him to feel better.
Right, it's piss. It's a piss-poor excuse.
It really is.
It's really... Because he doesn't know what's happened, it just sounds so bad.
It sounds weird. It just sounds weird.
It just sounds like she wanted to use him for sex.
Yeah, it sounds like she was horny and she needed to think of an excuse at the last minute. She's like, oh, I had a nightmare.
Yeah, given the context, I don't blame Tom for being so pissed off.
No, I'd be pissed off too.
Especially when his feelings are so hurt now. Like, he feels used.
Right, especially because he literally stood there and he was like, look, I'm open to getting back together.
I know, that was so sad. I now understand why the rest of the season goes the way it does with them.
Mm. Anyway, the kids then come downstairs, and because of Lynette's behaviour last night, Tom decides to tell the kids right now. She also, I will point out, she also says in this scene that it's a scary time for her right now, and so having Tom, that's the reason she's not been wanting to tell the kids, because having Tom so close by has helped her to feel safe.
So they finally tell the kids, which means that Penny's nightmare is coming true.
Yeah, the one that Susan told her not to worry about because it would never happen. So she lied.
She will never trust the Delfinos ever again.
No, she won't.
She'll be like, that Susan lady told me that this wouldn't happen and it happened. Mm. Liar.
Yeah, and I feel bad for Penny, Parker and Paige.
This means that every set of parents on this lane has separated.
Yes. However, Gabby and Carlos haven't separated since the kids.
That's true. That was before the kids.
That was before. Yeah. It was prior to the children for Gabby and Carlos. Everybody else have separated since there have been children involved.
So to this generation, Gabby and Carlos are the strongest couple.
Yeah. So that is Lynette and Tom's story.
Yeah, it wasn't a great story.
No,
in all honesty.
No, it really wasn't. It kind of felt like they really weren't sure how to write much for Lynette in this episode.
Yeah, and I can understand why the person from... who was it? I think it was TV Fanatic. The lady at TV Fanatic said that Lynette's storyline was basically not the one.
Yeah. Because I mean, this episode focuses on how the housewives have been affected by the crime they committed a month ago. And it kind of just feels like for Lynette, they weren't really sure how to communicate how it affected her.
Yeah.
She had a bad dream, fucked her husband.
I kind of like the idea behind it though. She's having nightmares. So we can see that she can't even sleep right now because of it.
Mm.
And so she's relying on the normalcy of her relationship, which isn't that normal right now, which is why she's not telling the kids. And there's like all these layers.
Yeah, but it just feels
In execution, I was like, this feels like a hot mess.
Yeah, but it feels like that's you getting that from that story, but that wasn't what was originally given in that story. That's just you getting it.
I think that was given. I think they just don't have to spell out.
I just don't think it was great. No, they don't have to spell it out, but they needed it to be stronger, and it wasn't stronger.
I think Lynette needed more scenes.
Mm.
There should have been a little bit, just a bit more of a focus on Lynette. At least one more scene. We could have taken more from Susan.
Yeah, Susan has a lot of scenes.
Why do we have to keep relying on Susan all the time?
Not that hamster scene, though. That's like one of the best scenes in this episode.
Yeah, she can stay.
She can keep that one.
Everyone's got like two or three scenes, and Susan's got like five.
Yeah. Anyway, Bree. So for Bree, obviously it being a month later, for Bree, the proof is in the pudding.
Love that line.
She is now living with Detective Vance, and they are lying in bed, and he wants to go away for the weekend, but it's Gabby's annual BBBQ this weekend, so they can't. It turns out Chuck doesn't believe Bree's friends like him, but she tells him that he's imagining things. He said it has been like it for weeks since the dinner party, because as a cop, he has an eye for noticing things like that.
But they're probably just awkward around him because of their secret. And this is the start of a villain arc.
It really is the start of a villain arc. Also, some people just aren't comfortable around cops. Mike isn't like an ex-convict.
Mm-hmm.
Gabby and Carlos are people of colour.
Mm-hmm.
So some people just maybe aren't very comfortable around.
Plus,
cops.
Carlos is a criminal.
That's
true.
He has
bank accounts offshore or whatever. We don't know if he still does or doesn't. Either way, I bet he does. He's a criminal.
I don't believe Carlos does anymore. Carlos has worked very hard to try and be a good guy, and it's in Carlos's defense, a lot of the time, it is Gabby that stops him from trying to be a good guy.
You know, that is true. I think the only reason that I'm remembering that is because we revisited Bang, and so that story has come back into my mind.
Yes, yeah. I
mean, Either way.
Carlos has made dodgy decisions in recent years as well. Let's not forget Lynette and the pregnancy situation. He's made dodgy, unethical decisions. However, I don't believe he is a criminal anymore.
Either way, they're probably just awkward around him because they've committed a crime which he has no knowledge of, so it just must seem so shady. I feel a bit bad for him.
Yeah, me too. Bree starts to panic because Chuck keeps thinking about what may have happened that night to piss her friends off, but she stops him from thinking about it anymore. And that's where the scene ends.
Yeah.
He then comes home to Bree baking cookies, and he has work gossip. He's also weird because nobody likes macadamia nuts.
No, ugh. Is it nuts and cookies?
Yeah, it's white chocolate macadamia nut cookies.
For God's sake.
What is it with the show macadamia nut cookies? Catherine baked them for Mike when he was in the hospital as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, and Susan didn't like them. Not because she's allergic, because she just didn't like them.
Yeah. Chuck found a body. Luckily for Bree, it wasn't Alejandro.
But she was panicked.
But the panic was there. Like, it was
Could
there.
You be more obvious, Bree?
Yeah, I know, right? What the fuck?
Thank God he wasn't looking.
Chuck originally says, oh, I won't talk about this anymore because you don't want to hear this kind of stuff when I've come home. And Bree's like, no, your work is fascinating.
Yeah, she's pretending to be like a true crime advocate all of a sudden.
Yeah, I know.
Even though Bree would not want to hear this.
Bree watched one episode of Making a Murderer and now here she is.
Yeah. But you know that in normal mode, Bree would be like, oh, we don't want to talk about your work stuff at home. It's too morbid.
Yeah, we don't discuss such morbid things at the dinner table, Chuck.
Right.
Anyway, so apparently Chuck is a hero because he cracked a case that others were struggling with. How? Because the dead guy had a car that's racking up parking tickets. And that is what Chuck noticed. He drove past the car, saw it had like a fuck ton of parking tickets. And he was like, who owns that car? And then that led to him finding the body. This is picked up on by Bree, who realizes that Alejandro probably had a car and they now need to find it.
I mean, they're so focused on the body, they didn't even think about a car.
Yeah.
Which does make sense. And this is why it's perfect to be a good liar and to be dating the local detective.
Exactly. All the women are there being like, you're the one dating a cop. Like, you, it's dodgy. Like, you need to be careful. It's a good idea for Bree to be dating a cop. If Susan were dating a cop, recipe for disaster. But Bree is kind of a sociopath. Like, she's a great liar.
She's a manipulative and good liar.
Yeah.
And I said this the first time I watched the show, and I still say it now. So from the get-go, I've been saying it's good to be dating this police officer. You have an in.
Yes.
But also such a conflict of interest, because it's like, I'm proud of him. He's good at his job, which, you know, you got to love for your partner. But also like, oh shit, he's got a job and he was there on the night and oh my God.
Yeah. So the next day, it's a great scene now.
It really is.
And I forgot this song has one of my favourite lines. And I forgot the line existed until Gabby said it. And then I was like, oh my God. It's not my favourite line.
I can't actually think of what it could be. So I'll just
We'll get there. I'll tell you. So I'm thinking about the scene. The next day, Bree and Gabby are out with Alejandro's car keys, just kind of walking the streets and clicking the button. How long have they been walking?
There's probably not that many streets he would or could have parked down, but still, it's America. They're bloody long.
They are long streets, and obviously he's parked it nearby Gabby's.
But probably not too close.
But not too close, because he doesn't want to get noticed, but we did see him on the street in the last episode. Bree and Chuck ran past him, remember? So yeah. It was about. So, yeah, who knows?
Still very funny, just walking around, just trying to find the car.
They find it eventually, and Bree's plan is to drop it off in a bad part of town and just kind of like let nature take its course.
Fantastic.
Great, great plan. Doesn't that happen? That happens with Andrew's car when he hit Juanita as well.
Oh, yeah.
They do the same thing, Bree and Rex.
See, Bree is, she's on it.
Bree's like, it worked for me before.
Yeah. Disturbing.
So, do you remember when I, like, my son ran over your mother-in-law? Well, this is what we did.
Let's not bring up fresh wounds.
So, they open the car door and see that it's a manual car or a stick shift some people.
It's a stick.
It's not an automatic. Gabby claims she can drive a stick and is quickly proven otherwise, as we have already seen in a previous season.
Well, she claims hesitantly. She's like, I haven't driven one in a long time. But she doesn't say, the last time I drove one was when I was bringing Hector's car back to my house, and it was really bad.
Yeah. So Gabby's bad driving, then gets them pulled over by Chuck.
Mm.
They make up a terrible story about a woman called Aunt Shirley who drank too much at book club, and they agreed to bring her car to her. But Chuck doesn't really think they should be driving this car and tells them that he'll drive it for them. And so they kind of get stuck in the dead guy's car with the police officer.
It's a shame that they couldn't find a way to get the car like clamped or something, like getting it taken away.
True, that's true. They could have just sold it. But
sold it.
That will probably leave, that will leave a paper trail. It's a paper trail. That's a bad idea, guys. Don't do that if you ever find yourself in this situation. In the car, he asks where she lives, which nobody can answer. And Chuck then finds a, I want to say baseball cap, the Oklahoma Redhawks. I'm not sure what team they are.
Nor are they. They're just like, oh yeah, she loves that sports team.
Yeah, but I'd do the same. That doesn't mean that I'm culpable of murdering the person. I'd just be like, yeah, that person loves that sport team.
Yeah.
I don't know the sport. It could be rugby, it could be tennis, I don't know. Anyway, he also finds a bottle of men's cologne, and the ladies sort of make Shirley out to be a baseball-loving, men's cologne-wearing lesbian.
Mm-hmm.
And then Chuck then finds a bag of chewing tobacco. But at the risk of taking things too far, Gabby takes one for the team and claims that she chews tobacco because Chuck's there like, I've never met a woman that likes to chew.
Yeah, he decides to start generalizing, which is never very helpful.
So Gabby grabs it and she's like, I chew tobacco and I'm a woman. So she starts chewing.
Oh, so disgusting.
This is one of the greatest lines, which just goes, all that's missing is a glass of Chardonnay.
Oh, right, yeah. It's so disgusting. I actually felt a bit sick when I was watching this scene, just at the idea of chewing tobacco.
It makes me feel sick. But yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, Gabby said that it's her auntie. Bree said that it's her friend. They've been panicking from the minute they saw it was Chuck that pulled them over.
He's a very good detective, though.
He's a very good detective, which is terrifying and kind of a turn-on.
But Bree shows off here that she can actually be pretty bad at lying.
Yeah, she really can be. If she's put on the spot, she's not good at lying.
No.
Like, we've seen this. If she doesn't have time to formulate something in her mind, then... And if she's lying with somebody else who's also bad at lying next to her,
Gabby,
it gets terrible. And Gabby, as we have seen several times, is an awful liar.
Oh, yeah. Horrendous.
Gabby can't keep up the chewing tobacco charade for too long, and Chuck has to pull over so that she can spit it out and vomit. He gets out to check on Gabby, and someone jumps into the car with a gun to steal it, but then quickly tries to back out when he thinks Bree is a bit of a freak, and she ends up telling him that a cop's right there. Like, he rocks up, and Bree's like, I could kiss you!
Shh, there's a cop right there.
So he tries to get out. She doesn't let him, and he tells him, like, she grabs his arm and pulls him back in and tells him to finish what he started.
Yeah.
And she gets out and lets him drive off with the car.
Yeah, when you start something, you see it through.
Buckle up!
This guy looks so confused. This is the weirdest car robbery he's probably ever done.
And the easiest as well.
Yeah.
He's rocked up and the other person just got out of the car. They're like, all right, take it.
Right, thanks, bye.
She then tells Chuck that Shirley happened to be walking by, and so she took the car.
Yeah, which wasn't... It's not a great lie, but it's better than saying that someone stole the car, because then he would start the whole car chase.
He would then start the whole, well, oh, okay, well...
And if he remembers the registration plate? Number.
Yeah, what's your registration? We'll get it sorted. We'll find the car too much, so... This whole scene, if I was Chuck, would have brought up red flags.
It probably does. We have to kill Chuck. Sorry, guys. We have to kill him.
Yeah.
Carlos, grab your candlestick.
But that is Bree's storyline.
Yeah. Right there. Very funny.
It was such a solid, solid story. It was hilarious.
Yeah. So dating the detective seems to have its pros and cons.
Oh,
it's great
absolutely.
To have an in,
yeah.
But he is very good at being a detective, and you ladies need to step it up.
Well, Gabby even says at the end of Bree's storyline, like the last line that she says is, how's that whole dating a cop while covering up a murder working out for you? Same as she's like, that was too close, like, and that's, this is your fault, almost implying that things wouldn't have taken this turn if Bree wasn't dating Chuck, which is an absolute lie, because Gabby's horrible driving would have gotten pulled over by someone at some point.
Yeah, exactly. You would have gotten pulled over by someone else, which would have gone worse.
Yeah, like, the good thing that you've got with Bree and Chuck right now is he's got bias.
Yeah.
He isn't going to look at Bree and assume that she's committing a crime. He is naturally going to want to believe her to a certain point where it then becomes too unbelievable.
Yeah.
Anyway, final story is Susan's. But Susan, she is harboring guilt. So she is being kept up at night, not really able to do anything but think about the crime from a month ago. Particularly about the fact that she can't actually tell Mike anything. And so she ends up getting out of bed and cleaning in a very OCD manner, which I would think, shout out to be Sister Jazz, is a very jazz thing to do.
Yeah, it is. Also, it's very funny that she's, over the past few episodes of the show, as in like the past five or six or something, so including the end of season seven, she's just turning more and more into Brie all of a sudden. Oh, look, I can cook, I can clean.
That's true, yeah.
But this must be very hard for her, because her and Mike, I get the idea that she's probably open and honest with Mike about everything.
Yeah.
Even to like an unusual degree for most couples.
Probably. They're a very solid couple. Yeah, they had their rough patch at, you know, earlier on in the show. But overall, they're a very solid couple.
But they've broken up before, and this will lead to their demise if it carries on.
Yeah. Yeah, guilt. Susan doesn't do well with guilt. We saw that after the accident which killed Dave's wife and child.
Mm.
The guilt that Susan felt ultimately broke up her and Mike.
Yeah.
So she's heading down that same road again. So she ends up cleaning OCD likewise by getting little earbuds and cleaning the corners of the window panes, which had dust coming up. Mike gets woken up by this, and this makes him concerned that something's going on with Susan that she hasn't told him about, because she isn't sleeping, eating, or leaving the house. She tells him that that's not true, she's subbing today, but he's also noticed that she isn't really speaking to the girls right now, so he tries to get it out of her, but she ends up going for a run instead of telling him. And outside, she ends up jogging herself right to the burial site for some reason.
Not returning to the crime scene, Susan.
Well, she's not returning to the crime scene, she's returning to the burial scene.
The
crime scene's Gabby's front room.
Yeah, but when people return to the crime, it's where the body is. I knew she'd be the downfall of this group.
Yeah, I know. The ladies, left alone after their little chat with Ben earlier, notice Susan running past and try to call her over, but she makes her excuses and heads inside, and apparently she isn't returning any of their calls. Gabby believes Susan is a loose cannon, and Brie believes things are getting too risky, but Lynette and Gabby then call out Brie's hypocrisy as she is dating a cop. She makes a valid point that it actually might be good to keep him close, but the girls don't seem to agree. We've harped on this already, so we don't really have much to say about that.
True, yeah. But yeah, Susan is a loose cannon. You're going to have to kill her.
You got to kill her. Susan and Chuck, you got to kill them.
Say that they were having an affair and it was a murder-suicide.
Yes, brilliant. At school, Susan is getting back into the swing of things, telling her teacher friend, the one that they've named twice, and I can't remember either of her names.
Well, let's say Ruth.
Yeah. Telling Ruth that this was just what she needed. However, Juanita notices that the class hamster, Cupcake, is dead.
You know, this is really sad. She's finally getting her job back, and this is the time.
And they don't explain how she got her job back either.
No.
She lost her job because she did internet porn, like, and cleaned and stuff like that. And then she tried to get it back and ended up accidentally almost poisoning the PTA.
I guess that whole situation was just sorted out, because they were like, oh, it was that Felicia lady. It's just really sad that she's starting her job again at this time, because she's clearly good at it, but it happens after this whole murder thing. Mm. It's so sad.
Apparently, the death of Cupcake is quite triggering for Susan, and all the kids start gathering round, and then Ruth tells her that they have a plot where they bury the class pets, so just take the kids, say a few words, but she also warns her not to mention God, because Amanda's parents are lawyers, atheists, and major douches.
Which is the show's way of saying that people that don't believe in God are douchebags.
Yeah. So at the school burial site, Susan is sitting there in silence whilst all the kids stand around confused. And Juanita chimes in with her sass, with her saying, I don't know if you've ever buried anything before, but you have to dig a hole.
I loved that line. It made me laugh out loud when I was watching it. I was like, what a sassy little cow.
Juanita is class clown over here.
Like, yeah, Edie Sass has definitely been replaced with this child.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's Juanita. Edie has been reincarnated into Juanita.
Serves you right, Gabby.
Susan starts talking to the kids about being in the wrong place at the wrong time, and about how she wasn't even supposed to be working today, and now this has happened, and then she begins to break down, and we have a clip.
Don't be sad, Mrs. Duff, you know. Cupcake was kind of a bad hamster. She had three babies and ate them.
But does that mean she deserved to die? We don't get to make that call, Juanita. We're not God.
That's right, Amanda, I said it.
It's not your fault.
I know it's not my fault, but try telling that to Cupcake's family when they show up looking for her.
There. We're done. Now let's all slap on a happy face and pretend like it's never happened.
Susan is really struggling to get her head around the fact that Alejandro had a family.
Yeah, that, I mean, it's not something that you want to think about. But Jesus Christ, Gail is not handling the situation well. And you kind of just want to shake her and say, Gabby and Carlos are at risk here. You need to pull it together.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
Like, he was a bad person. Let's not feel bad about the criminal.
Do they know about what he did?
Yes, they do. Because when Lynette, Brie and Susan walked in and saw Alejandro dead, Lynette was the one that said, isn't he the... And, like, kind of stopped. And Gabby was like, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's kind of implied that they all know.
The way that Juanita is having to comfort her teacher right now is so unhinged.
I know. My favourite part is where she just drops her cupcake into the hole and she's like, what have I done?
It's okay. Mrs. Delfino, it's not your fault. It's okay. But when she says he was kind of a bad hamster, I was like, oh my God.
Yeah, I know, right?
Juanita.
Here we go. It's life imitating art right now. Alejandro was a bad person. Cupcake was a bad hamster. Cupcake had babies and ate them. Like, Cupcake had children and abused them. Alejandro had children and abused them. Like, it's, even though obviously Gabby was not Alejandro's biological daughter, he was still in charge of children and abused them. It is literally an imitation of the other. Cupcake is the Alejandro of the hamster world.
If it wasn't Susan that had to keep the secret and it was Juanita, they'd be fine.
No, we'd have absolutely no problem. Juanita would be like, yeah, take it to my grave, whatever.
But yeah, Juanita's like, do you want me to get rid of the detective? Because I'll do it.
Yeah. Juanita's like, oh, who else do you need me to kill?
Susan's a fucking loose cannon. She's going to bring the whole team down.
Yeah. Anyway, that night, Gabby comes to visit Susan with a frozen cocktail to talk to her about the hamster situation.
Yeah.
Because Juanita has a big mouth.
And this clip is in... like Desperate Housewives best moment compilations all the time, when she has the two drinks and she's like, I bought you a cocktail, and she's like, oh, I don't want one. She goes, great. And then she just mixes the two together and starts drinking it.
Yeah, she pours one into her glass.
Yeah, and then she just walks in with this massive cocktail and starts drinking it herself. It's so great.
So Susan says it hit her in a weird way, and Gabby tells her that she's worried and making her nervous, begging her to hold it together. And it's in this scene where I really noticed that they've done a great job with having the lighting reflect the tone of the episode. And it's not really something I ever noticed before. Maybe it's because it's so jarring in comparison to other seasons of Desperate Housewives, which have a much brighter colour palette.
Yeah.
But this episode so far, obviously episode one of season eight, has a much darker colour palette. And when I was trying to watch it during the day, there were scenes where I was like, I'm struggling to see what's happening in the scenes. And it's because it's reflective of the general mood.
I finally got free to you of my film student crap.
I know, right?
I'm so proud of you.
Look at me. Look at me here.
Yeah, Gabby doing the guilt trip in to remind Susan what's up. And it's a sad scene as well.
It's a sad scene.
It's like she can't be like, look, I'm here for you. But she kind of rejects Susan's feelings in a way. But I get it.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard. It must be hard for Susan. Susan is a very compassionate person. Goofy, annoying, compassionate. She's...
Oh, yeah. Mary Alice made that very clear in the last or the second to last episode.
And what we've learned in the last seven seasons is Susan is a compassionate person. She does feel things very, very strongly.
Empathetic to a fault.
And, you know, she can't switch off that side of her. So I do feel for Susan, because this is an incredibly difficult thing for her to go through. But at the end of the day, Gabby's probably terrified because all it takes is for Susan to slip up once, like she's done with the kids.
Yep.
And that's it.
This is why I just want to shake her and say, can you just think about Gabby for a second?
Yeah.
Like, I know that you're empathetic and you're thinking about this man's family, but he was horrible. And the fact that he had a family and yet he still came back to find Gabby should tell you all you need to know about this situation.
Yeah, he left his family so that he could go and find Gabby, because Gabby was the one that was open about what happened to her. And he was like, I've come to find you because I've worked hard to bury that part of the past. I'm sorry, I'm glad you can bury it so easily, but I can't.
So I feel for you, Susan, but I can't say that I wouldn't do what Gabby does here.
Yeah.
Guilt trip you a little bit and say, try harder.
Yeah, basically.
Like, move on. Try harder to act like a normal human being, please, because mine and my husband's lives are at risk right now. More than yours.
Next scene, Mike is getting ready for the barbecue, but Susan doesn't seem to want to go. He gets worried because Susan doesn't really seem to be fine, and he feels like she's shutting him out. She then admits that she does have an issue, and she's got an issue with the girls, and she goes to sort it.
Well, it's as true as she can be in the moment, which is nice, because when he said that he was worried it was a problem with them, I felt really bad for him.
Yeah, me too. But now it gets a bit messy with the ladies. It's also the first scene this episode which we've had with the, all of them together.
Without her just running away.
Without Susan, like, escaping.
Yeah.
Like, so it was quite nice to see them all together again. So at the barbecue, she tells them that she's telling Mike. And Bree and Gabby disagree. Lynette thinks that they should let Susan tell him. And Bree reminds them all that they made a pact that night that didn't include all these extra conditions. And that this is when Lynette calls out Bree for taking control that night and not really asking anyone else what they wanted to do.
No.
Like she always does, no. According to Susan.
We can't turn on each other already. It's only episode one.
It's literally episode one and the girls are fighting.
The pact is falling apart. This is so, it's so awkward.
But it's interesting that it's bringing out everyone's, like, true feelings about each other. Lynette was like, oh, you didn't ask anyone. And Susan's like, yeah, you never do. Like,
you never do, Bree.
Yeah.
You just took control, as always.
As you always do.
And having watched all of season 8, it's a very triggering scene, this. Because now I can see where things are leading.
Yeah. Gabby steps in to defend Bree, and Susan tells everyone that it doesn't matter. She's telling Mike.
Oh, no.
This is why I like Bree and Gabby so much. Like, they have their turbulent, like, moments and what have you, but overall, like, Bree is there for Gabby, and that is Bree's mentality. Bree's like, I've done this horrible thing and I've done it for Gabby.
Yeah.
And I'm protecting Gabby and Carlos, despite the fact that it was only a couple of episodes ago that Carlos hated my guts and didn't want me to be a part of, like, we weren't friends of them. Regardless of that, I'm helping them. They're my friends.
Yeah, we've had a weird history of Bree being very horrid, but she's the kind of friend that you want because you can count on her. Let's hope that Gabby can return the favour in the future.
Well, Gabby is at the moment. She's stepping in and defending Bree. Like, Susan and Lynette are there saying, you took control. And Gabby was the one stepping in saying, well, you weren't.
Someone had to.
Someone had to take control. And it certainly wasn't bloody you, Lynette, the one that we expected it to be.
Yeah. The way that she was like, someone had to, kind of looking at Susan, I was like, oh, that's shady.
But someone did have to.
No, but the way that she looked at Susan when she said it, I was like, well, she's got a point.
Lynette was distraught. Like, she wasn't really saying anything. And Susan just kept going, we should go to the police. Like, fuck you, Susan, shut up.
Yeah.
So we then get another great scene. This happens all that we get these scenes all the time. It's like the fourth or fifth time we've had this scene where we see the girls in the background doing something when our focus is supposed to be on the thing in the forefront. The men are all talking sports whilst in the background all the women are physically fighting.
Yeah,
each other.
They're in the foreground chatting around a table and you can see them out the window.
It harkens to that wedding scene with Bree and Catherine. And she's running past with the cake and you've got the vows going on.
That very questionable moment for Catherine when she was losing her mind. She was like, someone help!
help!
Trying to save this cake. Yeah.
So Gabby, Lynette and Susan all end up falling into the pool, which then get the attention of the men who come outside to see what's going on. Susan pretends to lose an earring and says that the girls are helping her to look for it. And then Bree dives in as well, I guess, for fun.
Yeah, she's like, there it is. But I was like, why did you dive in? What was the point?
I don't know. So after that, they all dry off and the ladies have their first proper chat of the season, like their first proper heart-to-heart.
Finally.
Honest one. With Lynette opening up about how hard she's finding the separation. They all apologise for not really being there for each other. And Lynette mentions that the good thing about Mike not knowing is that the guys won't be implicated if they are found out.
Very true.
Susan tells the ladies that she'll try to live with the fact that she can't tell anyone. Ever. Susan. Ever.
Yeah, they agree. They can never tell anyone about this.
E-V-A-H. Ever.
I also really liked that they did comfort Lynette and just said, with everything that's going on, we really haven't been there for you. It's like she's just been dealing with all of this separation stuff on her own.
Yeah.
How horrible.
On top of the guilt that she's been feeling. Like, they've all got their own stuff going on, but Lynette seems to be, obviously, she's got more that she's having to deal with right now. In the end, Mary Alice talks about friends and how they help clean up after a party. And we see Gabby comforting Carlos, who still feels guilty. Renee comforting Lynette, who now feels lonely. Susan sweeping Gabby's porch and Bree taking out the trash. And then walking home, she notices that a letter has been delivered, which says, I know what you did. It makes me sick. I'm going to tell. Which is obviously the same letter Mary Alice got in season 1, episode 1 of Desperate Housewives.
Exactly the same. That is
paper and everything. Like,
that's
the same paper.
That's weird.
It is real weird.
So we finally have the season mystery.
We do.
Who the hell knows?
Who
wrote the letter?
Yep, who did it? Here we go. We've
Is it Chuck?
We've come full... It could be.
But then again, he's a detective. Why would he do it this way? But also, is it Chuck?
Is it Chuck? He's a detective. He's got access to all of their files, including Paul Young, Mary Alice, Martha Huber.
Do you think he's like doing this underhanded way of trying to get them to slip up?
Maybe. So that's the episode.
That was the episode. It was really funny, actually. It had some great moments, but my God, so much darker. Everyone's guilty. Everyone's sad. Everyone's lonely. Everyone's depressed.
I thought it was a really, really solid opening episode for a season. Like, I was cracking up when I needed to crack up. I was sad. I was scared. It was such a good episode.
Like, there's obviously a bit of bias, but I have to admit, it is quite impressive how they managed to handle such tonal differences with the funniness and how depressing it is.
Yeah.
Because it is a very dark episode.
Mm-hmm.
So, let's move on to the next part of the episode where we're going to talk about the gayest and the straightest moments, which is Joel's segment. So, please tell us, what do you have for the gayest moment?
My award for gayest moment I'm giving it to Gabby for her driving.
That's a bit rude.
Gays are notoriously bad drivers.
Yeah. It was so funny when they looked in the car and she goes, oh no, a stick.
We don't call it a stick, so.
Yeah, because it's just a manual car to us.
Yeah, like a manual car, it's a gearbox.
Yeah, right. We'd call it like a, you know, the gear stick or whatever.
Yeah,
so then just being like, ah, a stick.
Dogs, where they see sticks.
Stereotypically, as in the zeitgeist, stereotypically, the gays are bad drivers, so that makes sense. And then what do you have for the straightest moment?
My award for straightest moment. The award doesn't go to a person this episode. It goes to two things. Items get the straightest moment award in this episode. And those items are Ben's fish.
I knew it was going to be the damn fish.
Which is straight. And that bag of chewing tobacco.
Ugh, chewing tobacco, disgusting. Which,
I'm sorry, I don't know a single gay person that chews tobacco. Like, I don't know it.
Maybe in America. I think it's a Southern American thing.
It is a Southern American thing. I think it was an older Southern American thing. I don't really think anybody chews tobacco anymore. But I don't believe for a second there is a single gay guy out there that chews tobacco. And if you know a gay person, or if you are a gay person that chews tobacco, shout us out, okay? Tell me. Message me. I want to know you.
Yeah, because statistically, we don't believe it. And also, I don't think there is any self-respecting gay person, or most people, that would have a giant fish on their wall.
No. I mean, you...
Even straight people, all they do is catch the fish and get the stupid photo of them like, I'm only a fish. But to have a bloody fish on your wall?
Yeah, I don't know. I reckon you could get a few.
It's not like you've hunted it and you've stuffed it.
Some people do that.
I don't think about that. That's disgusting.
But yeah, no, it's just, yeah. Those are the gay awards.
Yeah. So the gay awards.
The gay awards.
These are all the gay awards.
So bravo to Gabby and that fish and bag of chewing tobacco.
Oh, yeah.
I wonder if we'll ever see that fish again.
I hope not. If we do, Renee, you've got some work to do.
Hey, Renee's got to get into the house first. Yeah. But she's struggling to even get an invite.
Wow.
So now we move on to B's awards for best and worst parent. So who do you have for the best parent?
No one.
You don't have anyone for best parent?
No. Although, in hindsight, I probably would have considered the atheist lawyers, because that's kind of fierce.
Amanda's parents.
Sorry, but I completely think that working your ass off to make sure that schools are not indoctrinating children into religion when religion should be a freedom of choice and practice outside of government, school, and all of that stuff. Fierce.
Yeah.
But I didn't give it to anyone.
They also made her look a bit like Wednesday Addams.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, she had the really flat, long hair and, like, the darker eyes. And I was just like, wow, they've really made her look like she's not atheist, but satanic.
They're like, atheists don't look after their kids.
Yeah. she doesn't believe in God. That doesn't mean she's like part of the Church of Satan. Let's relax.
Yeah.
So who do you have the worst parent?
So my award for
worst parent of the episode,
I gave this to Carlos for unnecessarily snapping up Juanita the first time she's ever done anything nice.
True.
She is never going to do anything nice ever again.
She won't. That's it.
They've shot themselves in the foot. Yeah. Terrible. So, bravo, bravo, fucking bravo to everyone for all of your awards this episode. If anyone has any questions, queries, comments and theories, where can they find us?
You can find us on Instagram at Boyfriends Review. You can find us on TikTok. You can, I love TikToks. You can find us on TikTok at Boyfriends Review, and we are also on Reddit at Boyfriends Review Pod.
We also have email, which is boyfriendsreview@outlook.com, and all of our artwork is done by our friend Louis, who you can find on Instagram at DocRedMonkDesign, and there's a link to his Etsy page, and he does do commissions. Join us next time when we'll be back in your ear holes with Season 8, Episode 2, Making the Connection.
Yes.
So, see you then.
See you then, guys.
Bye.
Bye.